the National Archives podcast series. From wheelchair polo to winning professionals, the history of the Paralympics, presented by Dr. Julie Anderson. This podcast was recorded live on the 30th of August 2012 at the National Archives, Kew.
Thank you very much for my invitation today. It's always a pleasure to speak at the National Archives. My paper today, From Wheelchair Polo to Winning Professionals, A History of the Paralympics, hopefully will engage you a bit more with the history of the Paralympics, also some of the bit weird and wonderful things that are associated with the Paralympics, and also what happens in what the holdings are in the National Archives on the history of the Paralympics. Okay, this year, London is a double Olympic city. And like our medal successes in the able-bodied games, we expect to mirror those achievements in the Paralympic Games. It makes sense that the Paralympics are being held in the home of their inception, as we saw last night during the opening ceremony. Although it's obviously Aylesbury and not London where the first Paralympics are held, and obviously in 1948 the first Olympics are held in London. So there's a nice association there. The National Archives holds a wealth of information about the Paralympics. Some are rather surprising and interesting, and some are actually quite hilarious. So I'm going to go through some of those today with you. While there's general agreement that 1948 is a watershed year in disabled people's sport, I'd like to say before I start a little bit more about sporting exploits by disabled people before 1948. Britain has a long history of sport for disabled people. You can see here we have the Deaflympics and the One-Armed Golfers Association. The One-Armed Golfers Association was established in the late 19th century and is quite a large organization. And the Deaf Games, as it was called in 1924 when it was first established, have been held since, as I said, 1924. And they've had their first Winter Games in 1949. So they're quite well ahead of what we consider the Paralympics, what becomes the Paralympics. Much of the participation for disabled people has its history in those injured from the First World War. Sport was used as a form of rehabilitation by St. Dunstan's and amputees at Roehampton. And you can see here some of the sport that St. Dunstan's did. They were mad keen on tug of war, partly because it's a military. These were war blinded. And rowing on Regent's Park Lake, and also tree climbing. And apparently lots of people would come around. They did sports every Saturday, and people would come around and watch them doing sport. They were in Regent's Park from about 1915 to at least the end of the war and then afterwards. And they would do walking races around Regent's Park as well. So they did quite a lot of sport for blind men, blind veterans. At Roehampton, is obviously, which is in London, they do a lot of different kinds of sport on the ground and also things like cricket. They're very keen on playing cricket as well, sometimes with their prostheses on, sometimes with their prostheses off. And these are just sort of photographs of them kind of sitting around. There's not a great deal, unfortunately, images of the men, the amputee men, doing any kind of sport, but they did quite a lot from the reports. They also did a lot of ragtime, what they used to call ragtime sports, fun sports. So they did a race. My particular favorite is the cigarette race, where you either run or wheel or get down to the end where a nurse is standing. You then light a cigarette. She helps you light the cigarette. You smoke it, and then the first person back wins. So that obviously takes place in the 1920s and wouldn't obviously happen now. But that is my personal favorite for a ragtime race. And it was quite popular amongst lots of people. So how did what we understand as the Paralympics start? Hopefully some of you may have seen the television program about the history on the BBC recently. But I'll set the scene for you anyway, if you either haven't, or I'll reset it for you. Stoke Mandeville Unit for the Spinal Injured, as it was called, was opened in February 1944 with little fanfare, it must be said, one ward and 28 beds. So it's one ward absolutely full of beds. It basically looked like a group of Nissan huts. Sadly, not any of them survive anymore, but it was essentially, as very many hospitals were in those days, a group of Nissan huts, because there wasn't a lot of space and plenty of injured people to put in them. They did treat burned airmen at Stoke Mandeville initially, but then it became more concentrated on the spinal injured and then obviously specialised, and it's still in operation today. Now, this is the man who, certainly the professor, the doctor, the neurosurgeon, Ludwig Guttmann, who is considered responsible for the Paralympics, as it were, as a visionary. Despite an initial lack of enthusiasm from the staff, who were of the opinion that there was little to be done for the spinal injured, because you've got to remember that the spinal injured had an 80% death rate prior to the advent of penicillin. So until 1944, pretty much 80% of people died if they had spinal paralysis. They would die from infections and complications associated with either bed sores or infections in the bladder. So what used to be done for these people is they used to be propped up into bed and they would sit there and make baskets and do what they could until basically they died. They didn't move around at all. And this was obviously a problem. And Guttmann could see that this was a problem, that obviously the complications from bed sores would ensure that they didn't survive. But what they would do is physiotherapists would just massage their limbs because the limbs would contort, and then they were just left in bed. So he decided this wasn't good enough. So what he did was he decided to exercise the patients in bed. And so they would throw medicine balls, which are pretty heavy if you've ever had one thrown at you, in bed. Special equipment like the Stoke Mandeville bed cycle was used. And what you did, you can see there's some handles there at the top here. And they would use their hands and pedal them like that. And it was developed for them to lie down, be recumbent, and yet still get some exercise, build up some muscles in their body. You've got to remember also that Guttmann's early patients are all young ex-servicemen, you know, and they were highly competitive. And Guttmann exploited the competitive instincts of these young men. They were trying to outdo each other all the time. So this is why exercise went on in the wards, so the newly injured could see what was happening and then aspire to have medicine balls thrown at them, I guess. Competitions were held in the wards as well. There was one of my favorites, I'll just tell you, one of my favorite one was the timed dressing exercise, where you had to get out of bed, get into your wheelchair, dress yourself, and then finish. And I think the record for that was 4 minutes. So that's fairly quick. So they would do these things and keep a tab of who was doing things the fastest and the best. So it was very important, that kind of association as well. The first moves towards active sport and games for those in wheelchairs. So they might have been doing some gym work, lifting some weights, maybe doing a few pulley exercises, very gentle pulley exercises that come from that start about in the 1920s, sort of resistance exercises as opposed to drill. But this actually comes not really from the medical establishment per se, not really doctors and physiotherapists. They do get the idea, but it comes more from the patients themselves. Two incidents had an impact on the development of sport for those in wheelchairs, which is what we're talking about early on. In 1944, Guttmann watched from a window while the staff were having a break outside, and they were throwing a ball to each other, had a break. And as he watched the patients play, the staff were throwing the ball to the patients and they were throwing it back. And he could see that they were exercising themselves, that they were using their muscles, using their bodies. And it was much less boring than, you know, I don't know how many of you go to a gym, but, you know, that can be very repetitive. And these guys were young, they wanted to get fit, they wanted to do things. And they were also, sport and games were also devised as something to pass the time as well, because a lot of these men were very shocked, very depressed, and they often had suicidal feelings and thoughts. And the sport was also a way to get them through that as well. So it was also really important, give them something to do. They didn't just want to sit and make baskets, although a lot of them said they had a physical aversion to raffia by the end of their time at Stoke Mandeville because they were doing so much basket making. So he brings in throwing balls. That's what they start with. Apart from the medicine balls and the competition in the wards, starts throwing balls outside. On another occasion, again in 1944, Guttmann discovered a number of patients on a piece of ground at the back of the hospital. They had upended walking sticks, so the curved handle was on the ground, and were pushing themselves around in their wheelchairs, attempting to hit a wooden puck. So Guttmann has this idea. He sees this game as another way to alleviate the boredom and the depression of young men who were shocked by the fact that they couldn't get around in the same way that they had previously. And obviously the wheelchairs in the 1940s are extremely heavy. They look like giant armchairs on wheels. Leather, heavy, weighed about 50 pounds. So trying to move that around was took quite a lot of effort. Gutmann was keen on sport. He'd run, played football, and also did fencing while at university. So he gets himself into one of these big wheelchairs and begins to practice what he calls wheelchair polo. And he says, "I tried to move about and, using the curved handle of a walking stick, hit the ball and chased after it. Simultaneously, I tried to prevent my opponent in another wheelchair from counteracting my movements," because of course he would get physiotherapists to come and work with him to see if they could get this game going. There seems to be no definitive reason why it was called wheelchair polo. It could have been called wheelchair hockey or any other name you want to call it. But the idea that the wheelchair was a kind of horse, perhaps, may have given rise to the name. Whatever its title, this game was the first in Britain that was developed specifically for wheelchair players. Although, I have been looking around, and I have found this image from 1915, which is of, obviously, men using what look more like croquet mallets, but they could be polo sticks. These are men in a convalescent hospital playing polo. Certainly hitting a ball in their wheelchairs is very interesting. So, you know, obviously some more research needs to be done on this. So the game begins to be played regularly at Stoke Mandeville, and the patients' team would play the orderlies and physiotherapists. And I can imagine that there was probably a bit of tit for tat there. You punish me in physiotherapy, I will get you at wheelchair polo. And you wouldn't blame them. The large, ungainly wheelchairs hampered the sporting competition and were responsible for a lot of frustration because they couldn't move around or turn very quickly. But nevertheless, the games were entered into with a huge amount of enthusiasm. Even occupational therapy became involved. In July 1945, the woodwork department makes goalposts and nets and mallets for the competition. But the game eventually had to be abandoned, sadly, over fears of health and safety, although obviously it wasn't called health and safety in those days. The players, however, did not share this concern for their safety. If you didn't come out of your chair at least once during the course of this game, you were considered by the other lads to be a sissy. Although wheelchair polo only lasts a few months, it had real impact, as it was the first wheelchair team sport played in Britain. And I'll talk about the Americans and basketball as we go on. The other sport that was developed for the patients was archery. Gutmann invited the champion English archer, who was called Frank Bilson, to Stoke Mandeville to teach the patients and also teach the physical instructors how to shoot. Archery proved a popular pastime, and as with wheelchair polo, the occupational therapy department was put to good use in constructing all the equipment. So the patients would make equipment and then use it to conduct their sporting endeavors as well. So, on July 28th, 1948, an archery competition was held on the lawns outside Stoke Mandeville. The numbers of special units for paraplegic war veterans had increased, actually, and there was one at the Star and Garter Home in Richmond in Surrey, so not far away. Their spinal unit was challenged to a match, because Gutmann was also a consultant to the major spinal units for the war veterans in Britain at this time. So he had his fingers in all the pies, and it meant that, you know, there was a good competition between these groups of men, again, pushing this competitive side to things. 16 competitors were involved in total, and two were women from Stoke Mandeville. And the idea of it, there being women in it, is extremely important and very interesting, which I'll explain in a minute. The Star and Garter emerged victorious and were awarded the Challenge Shield, which was specially made for this first contest. The shooting was only part of the festivities, however, at Stoke Mandeville that day. Actually, the archery was just an aside. The main focus was a visit from the Minister of Pensions, who was giving them, and you can see on your left at the top, a bus. And the bus was actually the focus of the day. Hilary Marquand was the Minister of Pensions at the time, and he was presenting the paraplegic bus so that the men and women could go on outings and go to work. So it was very, very important because it meant some sort of transportation freedom. There is no way, in any way, that this is considered a moment in time that's really important at the time. It was just something that happened because they were having a bit of a festival because they were getting the bus. And they wanted to demonstrate to the Minister of Pensions of the work that they were doing at the hospital. They were, as usual, the patients were very keen on it, and they wanted another one. So they actually had another one in September the same year, but possibly that one's not mentioned as much because it sort of wasn't summer, it wasn't the Olympics, it doesn't have that connect. Whereas they actually do have another one in September, actually. So I've just ruined it for everybody there. So the decision's made to hold another one in 1949, and there were then, it went from 16 to 60. So it was an increase in the number of people that wanted to have a go. Each team was comprised of ex-service people. There was a women's only team this time, and a group of Polish men competed, and they were from Penly in Wales. That's where they had a rehabilitation unit there for mainly Polish airmen. And they came and also did some archery. And as I recall from the reports, they said that, you know, it was very sporting of them to come because they weren't very good. And, of course, the Poles beat them hollow in 1950. But that's another story. More annual competition followed, and in the 1950s. 1950s is actually really important for the Paralympics. It's not obviously called the Paralympics at this time. Because many of the traditions we associate now with the Paralympics come into being. Right through the 1950s. In 1950, the name of the competition is changed to the Stoke Mandeville Festival of Sport to kind of reflect the Festival of Britain. And people who had industrial accidents, such as coal miners, started to come. So word of mouth got around and different people wanted to come. So it was all spinal injured, but they still wanted to come and participate in several sports. Javelin starts to be thrown in 1950. You have archery and netball as the main events. And apparently there was quite a number of people who showed up. That's a picture. Again, there's some table tennis as well. That's Ludwig Gutmann at the bottom talking about thanking people and doing presentations. There'd been much discussion by the Games Committee throughout the early part of 1951 about the inclusion of recreational games, so having a more artistic or recreational side to the proceedings. This may have been because there are fewer disabled ex-servicemen only at Stoke Mandeville. They're getting more civilians, as it were. And there was a number of people who resisted the sporting culture. Some people didn't like it, and they didn't want to do it, and they didn't feel competitive. And they wanted to do other things. So in 1951, the organizers added snooker to the program and included table tennis, which you can see is a demonstration sport. For the first time in 1951, the variation of the Olympic opening ceremony was organized. During the opening ceremony, a group of women participated in Indian club swinging to music, which is very different, obviously, from the extravaganza of last night. 1952 was a benchmark year for the Games, as they included international competitors for the first time. Six members of an archery team from a military rehabilitation center in Arnhem, Holland, arrived to compete in the archery events. Their attendance was supported by sponsorship from the World's Veteran Association, whose funding program provided assistance with paraplegic sport, and you can see them meeting people from Stoke Mandeville. The arrival of the Dutchman was not the only innovation in 1952. 1952 was a bit of a big year because the complicated classification system used in contemporary disabled sport has its roots in these games. So when we things like, you know, T this or something and different numbers referred to, in order to ensure fair competition. I mean, if you saw the opening ceremony last night, you would have seen, heard them talking about the different classification system. And it is quite complicated, and it has become slightly more simplified, but it did get incredibly complicated in the sort of 70s and 80s. But that is initiated in this game. So it's initiated quite early in 1952. News of the Stoke Mandeville Games reaches other countries because in 1953, the group representing the Netherlands comes back, and this time they're joined by teams from Canada, France, Finland, and Israel. The club swinging continues as part of the opening ceremony. They have club swinging for quite a number of years. And they also have a special march that was composed for the games that year. It wasn't the music. If you heard the composition last night, the Paralympic anthem, it's not the same one. It's a different one. While many sports at Stoke Mandeville were variations on already existing games that able-bodied people played, there were some combined features that developed a new kind of game and a new kind of competition. Dartchery was a variation on archery and darts. And surprisingly, it was devised by a group of paraplegics from Leeds. Due to the often inclement weather in Britain, many paraplegic archers were forced to participate on a short course in a gymnasium, or indeed at home, which seems to be happening here on your right-hand side. Looks like he's playing at home. In an attempt to compensate for the tedium of shooting at the same target from short distance, the paper cover, which you can see a man colouring in, now you can get them printed up. But Dartchery is no longer played anymore. It stopped in the 1980s, but I'm sure people play it still. So you have the same, similar points for darts, except it was played on an archery board, so you could get quite accurate, and it was another way of trying to alleviate the boredom of shooting at the same target. Other sports were added through the 1950s in a rather sort of ad hoc fashion, actually. Generally, they were able-bodied games adapted for wheelchair sports. New facilities at Stoke Mandeville made it possible to improve the variety of therapy, and then also from that sport, which seems to be how it worked there. An indoor pool was built in 1953, and during the year, swimming provided spinal injured with those paralyzed by polio, because we're getting increasing numbers of people paralyzed by polio. And it was used in 1953 to hold classes, events in swimming. The backstroke, breaststroke, and crawl, or freestyle, were all swum in the pool from 1953. The spread of internationalization prompted the addition in 1954 of a wheel past, as it was known, which was a copy of the march past of the Olympic Nations, which everybody knows, obviously, after seeing two opening ceremonies, takes forever, where the different group countries push themselves past a saluting base, carrying their flag, while the Stoke Mandeville march was played. And there you can see an image of the wheel past. And they all seem to be coming quite quickly, so it obviously probably didn't take very long. This wheel pass becomes a permanent feature of the games from 1954. Fencing was demonstrated in 1954 and included in 1955 for men and 1956 for women. So there's a range of sports. By 1955, the number of nations competing increased to 18 teams, including one from the United States, who easily, much to everyone's annoyance and for years afterwards, won the basketball event due to their skill and lighter wheelchairs. Roger Bannister and other famous sporting personalities and Olympic competitors were invited to the Games. He awarded prizes at the 1955 Games and was generally very much approved of, obviously, as an athlete himself. And he said that he felt that they were watching in the same tense atmosphere as watching Olympic sport. Other sports get included, shot put in 1957. 1959, interestingly, they have a pentathlon, which consisted of archery, swimming, shot put, javelin, and throwing the club. And this is significant, and the reason why it's significant, because it attests to the general fitness levels of people. As you know, you have to be pretty fit to do all those events for a pentathlon. And indeed, this kind of shows Gutmann's determination that wheelchair athletes would eventually be able to compete in a copy, their own version of similar events that the able-bodied already did. In 1957, the Olympic Committee recognized the Paralympics, although they don't call it the Paralympics, and gives the Fairnley Cup to the Stoke Mandeville Games. It was presented to any sports club or organization who supported and improved and enhanced the Olympic movement. And Arthur Porritt, who's a leading member of the British Olympic Committee, announced that nothing could exemplify more the spirit of the Olympic movement than the Stoke Mandeville Games. They don't have a torch relay in the Stoke Mandeville Games in the 1950s, but they do have their own equivalent, and it has a little interesting story. They have a scroll which gets presented, and it usually gets presented in a northern city. So one year it was presented in Manchester, for example. And four runners, usually in motorized wheelchairs, would take it They would either sit in the car if they didn't drive, and if they did drive, because obviously adapted cars were available from 1948 for people who had been injured in the war, they would take them to Aylesbury. But in 1957, which was the first one, the first opening ceremony had to be delayed because the final runner's unreliable motor chair, because these motor chairs were from the First World War and they were very unreliable. So basically when you went out in one, you take a toolkit with you. So what they would do, it had broken down several miles outside Aylesbury, so they had to drive out and rescue them and drive them back. So it was kind of, the opening ceremony was slightly delayed. But they got there at the end, and so that became a feature as well after 1957. Winning the netball competition, netball slash basketball, there didn't seem to be much differentiation between the two. When the Americans came, it was called basketball, and the British, it was called netball. Obviously, everyone got rather miffed because the Pan Am jets from the United States arrived. And this was highly problematic because efforts to beat the Americans in their polished aluminium chairs proved impossible for everyone at the Stoke Mandeville Games. Of course, Britain had reigned supreme in netball, so they weren't very happy about this. The British team initially said that their lack of success was down to the rationing that was still going on in Britain till 1954. The real reason was probably that the Jets had some of the characteristics of a professional sporting team. And this is quite early. This is the middle of the 1950s. Or early 1950s, sorry. They had sponsorship by Pan American World Airlines, who rented a gymnasium for them, which allowed training three nights a week and Saturday and Sunday mornings. A professional coach, Junius Kellogg, a one-time Harlem Globetrotter, himself in a wheelchair after a motor vehicle accident in 1954, was hired in 1958 also to train them. The British team, who had reigned supreme, did not have much chance of victory against such a well-trained and funded opposition, so they got rid of them. So they said they were professional football. They said they were a professional basketball team, and therefore they couldn't play anymore. So thereby ruining that for the Americans, and then there was a, you know, as far as everyone else was concerned, a much better competition. So if you can't do that, why not? And you can see, obviously, they're playing sort of in their wheelchairs. You can see they look quite light, foldable wheelchairs. Not the sports wheelchairs, obviously, that you see today, specifically for sport. But we go into the 1960s with the culmination of all the hard work of Gutmann and the disabled athletes when the first International Stoke Mandeville Games for the paralyzed, as it was called then, was staged. That's some groups of teams, and I'll explain why they're standing out, they're sitting in their wheelchairs outside these buildings. It's also where we see many documents in the National Archives, mainly in the Foreign Office files and Ministry of Health files. So many of the venues were used, because we think nowadays, with the Paralympics, the venues are used again. So the Olympic athletes use them, followed by the Paralympians. Yes and no in the 1960s. 400 competitors went from 21 countries, and took part from the 18th to the 25th of September. And Gutmann wrote that it was the real fulfillment of his dream. For the first time, these games followed closely upon the Olympic Games in Rome. Competition was under Olympic rules and took part in one of the Olympic stadiums. That statement slightly stretches the truth, as the Italian authorities had denied access to the Olympic Stadium at the last minute, basically, save for the opening ceremony, which probably had club swinging in it. I'm not entirely certain. The only venue that they were allowed to use was the Olympic swimming pool. Sporting events actually took place in a stadium which was 40 minutes bus ride away from the Olympic Village. Although the participants were allowed to stay at the village, which is why you see so many photographs of them outside the village, because that was the real Olympics, and understandably people wanted to be photographed outside the Olympic Village where they were staying. They were refused permission to stay in any accommodation that was serviced by a lift, however. So ramps had to be built to get them to their flats. So they built all these ramps on the Italians, built all these ramps on stilts to get them up to these flats instead of allowing them to stay on the ground floor for some bizarre reason. And many of the athletes had to be carried by the Italian military, which apparently some people enjoyed enormously. But it really was sort of a bit of a mishmash, very unlike the polished professional games you see nowadays with complete sharing. 1964 Tokyo Games, And this is the second time running that the Games are held in the same city as the Olympics. Japanese people supported the event, setting attendance records at, apparently, according to reports, 100,000 people. So that's significant. A record number of nations attended as well. British team took home 21 gold, 27 silver, and 23 bronze medals. But there wasn't a great deal of publicity for the Games, either during or after the event. A Foreign Office report concluded, it was difficult to devote much time or thought to the Paralympics when all was dominated by the Olympics. The able-bodied Games were of such importance that the departing able-bodied athletes did not know that their disabled compatriots would be using the facilities of the Olympic Village after them. There just was no publicity whatsoever. And I have a report here, a little bit of a report from the Foreign Office, who were quite annoyed about this. It cannot be very pleasant for the newcomers to notice here and there signs of hooliganism, such as the mess made by fire extinguishers let off by members of the Olympic teams on their last night. Our people included a few individuals who were rather exuberant in this and similar ways, but who might have been more restrained if they had realized their actions were likely to affect the amenities of their successors. Despite the lack of press coverage of events in Tokyo, when the athletes came home, the Paralympians, they received government recognition for their success at a reception held at Downing Street for 300 guests, which costs £300. I have that from the word of mouth from the Ministry of Health archives. The Prime Minister, Harold Wilson, was in attendance and met with the athletes, although there was a lot of discussion, this is in the documents, of how they would get the athletes into Downing Street, as it was not really made to accommodate wheelchairs. Harold Wilson spoke at the second reception, so there was another one, held for the competitors who had returned from Israel in December 1968. So you can see the athletes had to come up in the service lift. It was very hard to get them anywhere into the building, but they did get them into the building and apparently had a nice time both times. So the reason that the Games were held, obviously the able-bodied Games in 1968 after the second party that I just mentioned, were held in Israel for the Paralympians and obviously Mexico City for the able-bodied. Throughout the history of Games for disabled people in Britain, different groups had kept their activities separate. For instance, Stoke Mandeville had always only represented the interests of wheelchair athletes. This was changed in 1961, where you get some blind athletes and also some athletes with amputations, and there starts to be a bit of cooperation. They formed the British Sports Association for the Disabled in 1961, but they still keep their sports separate. Although the groups could go and use all the facilities, because all the facilities were there at Stoke Mandeville and Aylesbury, so they could go and hold their own sport, which they do, there was no question of them participating in the Paralympics. They remained what those at Stoke Mandeville called, interestingly, pure, meaning there were no events for any other competitors other than those with spinal injuries. This does change, obviously. Weightlifting and lawn bowls get added in the 60s, and by 1968 there are 37 events for people to go into, and obviously at different levels because of the classification system. And the competition is spread over 4 days, so it's quite big. But in 1965, the International Paralympic Committee raised objections to using the term Paralympic. Even though it wasn't in the title, it was still, they used to call it Stoke Mandeville Games, but they would call them Paralympians, and there was a reference to this. The International Stoke Mandeville Games Committee was happy to accede with their request that they don't use the term Paralympian, as they felt it would be more fitting to be reminded where the Games had originally taken place than change the title of the event. So Paralympics continued kind of as a casual reference, but it's not until the 80s that the IOC gave permission to use the term. And I just want to mention another Games that people don't know a lot about, which is also in the National Archives papers, which is the Commonwealth Paraplegic Games. There actually was a Commonwealth Paraplegic Games from 1962. First one's held in Perth, limited to Commonwealth countries, so no nasty Americans in their fabulous wheelchairs to kind of ruin it for everybody. They often use the same venues, which is great. So they used all the Commonwealth sporting venues. And they also did experiments on the athletes. So when they flew to Perth from Britain, they did lots of experiments on them just to see how people with spinal injuries flew. What happened? Did they get swollen legs? You know, what happened when they were on a plane for a prolonged period of time? There was another one in Jamaica in 1966, Edinburgh in 1970. The number of participant countries increased to 15 in 1970, but they ended in Dunedin, New Zealand in 1974, and there are no more and have been no more, mainly because of lack of funds, essentially. So as a historian, because I concentrate on history stuff, I am just going to sort of give you a few details from the 70s and 80s and 90s. There's obviously files available from 1982 here, but I'm just going to say a little bit about recent events. Because 1976, for example, is extremely important as the Toronto combined games. So blind and amputee athletes competed alongside wheelchair athletes for the first time. Obviously, the original Olympics, the able-bodied Olympics, was held in Montreal in 1976, is held in Toronto in 1976 for disabled athletes. In 1980, athletes with cerebral palsy join in, and they go to Arnhem in the Netherlands. As the Soviet Union refused to respond to requests from the Stoke-Mandeville Games Committee, South Africa was excluded on the grounds of its apartheid policy. So the Games for Disabled People, the Paralympics, mirror the same issues as what's going on in able-bodied sport. The Winter Games, first held in Sweden in 1976, so 1976 was a big year, and I particularly like wheelchair curling. I think that looks great. Financial problems and lack of sponsorship affects the games basically until 1996. The 1984 Summer Games, which everyone knows was able-bodied, was in Los Angeles, was originally supposed to be held in Chicago at the University of Illinois. It gets pulled at the last minute, so they divide it in half. The wheelchair athletes go to Stoke Mandeville, and everybody else goes to Long Island, New York, to do their sports. So they basically do it in two locations, because the University of Illinois pulls out 3 months before the games are supposed to start due to lack of funding. But in 1988, Seoul is the first city the Paralympics were held in the same city as the Olympics for some time, and it just, you know, it sort of improves from there. This is repeated in 1992 in Barcelona. In that year, the International Sports Federation for Persons with an Intellectual Disability participated in their own games in Madrid, directly after the Paralympics in Barcelona, because people with intellectual disabilities and people with physical disabilities were still separate as well. Although, obviously, there has been games for people with intellectual disabilities since 1968. They're always separate. But in 1996, this changes in Atlanta, where you get the International Sports Federation for Persons with an Intellectual Disability are awarded full medal status. In 1996 in Atlanta, the Paralympics received sponsorship. So that makes a huge difference to the staging of the games, as we know from, say, the Olympics with the lots of McDonald's and Coca-Cola. Whereas 1992 is kind of felt to be the coming of age for the Paralympics in the sense of broad enthusiasm. Barcelona is seen as this changing moment. People are recognizing disabled athletes as athletes, not just as poor people who needed to be helped along. These are professional athletes. So that happens in Barcelona, but in 1996, you get a coming of age in the financial sense, because you get sponsorship. The decision to award medals to athletes with intellectual disabilities results in controversy, unfortunately. However, in 2000, at the Summer Paralympics in Sydney, which is again also in the same city as the able-bodied games, there was huge controversies in Sydney. There were numerous positive drug tests, because all athletes know the availability of performance-enhancing drugs. Not saying they use them, obviously, but they are there, they're available, and some disabled athletes were disqualified for using performance-enhancing drugs. But the big problem was with the Spanish basketball team. I don't know if anyone remembers this. Spain is stripped of its intellectual disability basketball gold medals when a member of the victorious team, who's also an undercover journalist, revealed to a magazine that most of his colleagues had not undergone medical tests to ensure they actually had an intellectual disability. 10 of the 12 did not have the requirement. So their team was disqualified. Unfortunately, this has a knock-on effect because all official sporting activities involving an intellectual disability at Paralympic games level, not necessarily sporting competitions, were basically banned until November 2009. And they come up with, I don't know, years ago in the 1980s, they had gender testing to make sure that women were women when they were doing sporting events in the 1950s, 1960s. Now, for claimed disabilities, there is a sports intelligence test. There's also been controversies over drug and body manipulation in the Paralympic sports, which again mirrors issues in able-bodied sport. Things like in the 80s, I mean, it's much more sophisticated now, can be done in a much more sophisticated way, but raising your blood pressure by wrapping your legs in plastic wrap in order to raise your blood pressure and improve your performance. Things like people wearing very long prostheses when they ran, so they were 5'9" in their daily legs, and 6'2", which obviously would make your stride a lot longer, in your sporting legs. So these were problems that were highlighted in an article in Sports Illustrated. So in the early 1990s, so this was an issue. Hopefully, these have become a thing of the past with the incredible testing that they do at obviously able-bodied and disabled sporting events. I'm just going to show you the medal totals for 2008. I compared the Paralympics with the Olympics. This will just give you an idea of what the difference is between the two. Obviously, the Olympics, there are 958 available medals. In the Paralympics, there are 1,431, and that was in Beijing in 2008. So you can see that there are many more events for Paralympic athletes, even though there isn't necessarily the same number of sports. There's certainly lots of events because of the classification system, so it ensures fair play for everybody. The other one is my paper in a graph. So I looked at the Olympics, where they were held, where the Paralympics are held, the UK medals that were won, because I was being a bit pro-British today, the ranking in the Paralympics, and who we were beaten by in the medal tables. And you can see the lowest we ever came as a British nation was 1976 and 1980, where we were fifth behind the US. And obviously in 2008, we were second, only behind China in the number of medals that we took home. And hopefully this time in 2012, we will be number one because we have the advantage of a home audience. We will see. Okay, I wanted to give you a quiz at the last minute. If anyone can recognize, I expect one will be very familiar to you. I wanted to know if anybody knows who any of these people are. Anyone know who any of those people are?
Discourage at the bottom.
Yep, and I'll tell you a little bit about these. These are all people who have disabilities, who have participated in able-bodied games. Obviously, at the 2012 Summer Olympics in London, Oscar Pistorius became the first double-leg amputee to participate in the Olympics, where he entered the men's 400 metres and was part of the 4x400 metres relay team. What I'm trying to say is that is not all that unusual. There are a number of people, but these are the most famous ones that I chose. Well, actually, I chose Liz Hartel because I probably no one would get it, and then I could be smart. But anyway, Liz Hartel had polio in 1944 and started riding horses as a type of therapy. She believed that the muscle wastage was helped by riding. She had to be lifted onto her horse, but once she was astride this horse, which is called Jubilee 2, another reason why I chose it, she won the silver medal in the dressage competition in 1952. When doctors told Wilma Rudolph's mother that she'd never walk because of infantile paralysis caused by polio, and she had braces on her legs, you can see in the picture she actually wears a brace on that ankle, which she always did, because her ankle was slightly weak. She went to her first Olympic Games in 1956 in Melbourne when she was 16 and won a bronze medal. But at the 1960 Olympic Games in Rome, Wilma Rudolph became the first African woman to win three gold medals in Olympic history, the 100-meter dash, as it was called then, the 200-meter dash, and she was the anchor leg on the 400-meter relay team. So there is historical, you know, there are things that went before Oscar Pistorius. So finally, the Stoke Mandeville Games left a number of legacies, which we can see as the Paralympic athletes start their competition today. Stoke Mandeville had important ramifications, for example, for exercise for women with spinal injuries. It was a direct result of the Games that women began to compete internationally in wheelchair sports in Britain much earlier than women in any other nation. American women did not participate until 1962, while women in Britain have been competing in the Stoke Mandeville Games since 1948. Another interesting aspect is the role of sport and exercise, which is obviously great if you like it, but as Ian Drury pointed out, it is awful if you don't. And he absolutely hated what he called the militaristic aspects of Stoke Mandeville, where he had gone. But sport is kind of firmly, and games and exercise and activity, it's firmly entrenched in a program of rehabilitation after injury nowadays. What's even more interesting for us nowadays and for our Paralympic team that are going forward today is that participation is not just limited to war veterans, as it was many years ago. The British team is only made up of 2% disabled veterans, which means that the Paralympics, in this case, is certainly sport for all. Thank you very much.
This podcast is copyright to the National Archives. All rights reserved.